This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. There has been strong criticism at the United Nations of Russia's latest moves in Ukraine. We get more details from AP correspondent Norman Hall.
So the United Nations have condemned Russia's rush hour missile attacks on the capital of Kyiv and other regions of Ukraine. Russia has said that it was retaliating for what it called a Ukrainian terrorist attack Saturday on a strategic bridge. Ukrainian Ambassador Sergei Kislytsia says the Russians committed war crimes by deliberately targeting civilians.
Suffering defeats on the battlefield, Russia takes it out on the peaceful residents of Ukrainian cities.
A UN vote is expected this week on a resolution condemning Russia's recent annexation of four regions of Ukraine. I'm Norman Hall.
And the assembly meeting was planned before Monday's barrage, but countries used Monday's meeting to speak on Russia's rush hour attacks hours earlier. The Ukrainian ambassador says that some of his own close relatives were imperiled and unable to take cover in a bomb shelter. Russia says it was retaliating for what it called a Ukrainian terrorist attack on Saturday on an important bridge. The U.S. has warned Hong Kong that its status as a financial center could be affected if it acts as a safe haven for sanctioned individuals, days after a luxury yacht connected to sanctioned Russian tycoon Alexei Muratov docked in the city. A U.S. State Department spokesperson said in a statement Monday that the possible use of Hong Kong as a safe haven by individuals evading sanctions from multiple jurisdictions further calls into question the transparency of the business environment. Hong Kong's marine authorities have said that they do not implement unilateral sanctions imposed by other jurisdictions. More at voanews.com. This is VOA News. Former Hurricane Julia has dissipated, but it's drenching Guatemala and El Salvador with rain after reemerging in the Pacific. Julia is believed to have directly or indirectly caused the deaths of about 23 people, 28, I should say. Now, Julia hit Nicaragua's central Caribbean coast as a hurricane on Sunday and arrived and survived the passage over Nicaragua's mountainous terrain, becoming a tropical storm before it dissipated on Monday. Its winds had dipped to 35 miles per hour, but Monday morning, according to the U.S. National Hurricane Center, 14 people died in Guatemala, 4 in Honduras, 9 in El Salvador, and 1 in Nicaragua. The United Nations Security Council is now evaluating options, including the immediate activation of foreign troops to help free Haiti from the grip of gangs that has caused a scarcity of fuel, water, and other basic supplies. Such a force would remove the threat posed by armed gangs and provide immediate protection to critical infrastructure and services, as well as the secure of the free movement of water, fuel, food, and medical supplies to main ports and airports to communities and healthcare facilities. That's all according to a letter UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres submitted to the Council on Sunday. Officials in southeastern Nigeria say that 76 people, including many women and children, are missing after a boat capsized in the region. Nigeria's National Emergency Management Agency told the Associated Press on Monday that the authorities have not been able to access the area to search for victims. Godwin Thickman, the zonal head of NEMA, said that the only 9 people had survived the tragedy Friday. Officials say that the boat was crowded with people fleeing floods in Nigeria's southeast Anambra state. Nigeria's battling its worst floods in a decade, blamed mainly on the release of excess water from Lagdo Dam in neighboring Cameroon, and also the unusual rainfall. Recapping our top story, there has been strong criticism at the United Nations for Russia's latest moves in Ukraine. The General Assembly is now debating whether to demand that Russia reverse course on annexing 4 regions of Ukraine. The discussion is coming hours after Moscow's most extensive missile strikes in months and alarmed much of the international community. There is more at voanews.com. Again, that is voanews.com. Via remotes, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Today is Tuesday, October 11th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Afo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, Russia missiles rain down on Ukraine cities as the Kremlin orders revenge for the bombing of a Crimea bridge.
Russia fired cruise missiles at cities across Ukraine, including the capital Kyiv, during rush hour on Monday morning, killing civilians and knocking out power.
North Korea says its recent missile launches are simulated nuclear weapons to, quote, hit and wipe out, unquote, potential South Korean and U.S. targets.
It is always dangerous there, and the present situation is no exception. The dangers go up and down. It's sort of like a roller coaster over the weeks, months, years, and decades.
And the UN mulls sending troops to Haiti to confront armed gangs hampering aid delivery to the impoverished nation. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. Russia launched on Monday its most widespread airstrike since the start of the Ukrainian war, raining cruise missiles on cities during rush hour and knocking out power and heat. President Vladimir Putin called the attacks revenge for last week's Crimea bridge blast. Lucy Field of Reuters has more.
Russia fired cruise missiles at cities across Ukraine, including the capital Kyiv, during rush hour on Monday morning, killing civilians and knocking out power. In what President Vladimir Putin declared to be revenge for Ukrainian strikes, including on a vital bridge that links Russia to the annexed Crimean Peninsula. Downtown Kyiv saw the most intense bombardment since Russia tried to take the capital early in the war. A huge crater gaped next to a children's playground. Burnt-out cars scarred the streets. Emergency services tended to the injured. Explosions were reported in many other cities, including Lviv, Dnipro, Kharkiv and Zaporizhia. Swathes of Ukraine lost power, water or heat. In a televised address, Putin said Ukrainian secret services had carried out terrorist acts against Russia, including the attack on the bridge. He'd ordered the missile strikes because that couldn't go unanswered, Putin said.
If attempts to carry out acts of terrorism on our territory continue, Russia's response will be harsh and its scale will correspond to that of the threat made against the Russian Federation. No one should be in any doubt about that.
Ukrainian officials were jubilant after the bridge blast, which humiliated the Kremlin. But Kyiv has not claimed responsibility. Monday's strikes were cheered in Moscow, where authorities have faced unusual and sustained public criticism of the war after weeks of setbacks on the battlefield.
That's Lucy Field of Reuters. European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen condemned the Russian firing of cruise missiles at cities across Ukraine during rush hour on Monday morning, killing civilians and knocking out power and heat. Estonian Prime Minister Kaja Kallas called on NATO countries and allies to provide Kyiv with air defense, quote, so that the Ukrainians can protect their cities, unquote. Ukrainian reporter Anna Chernikova was in Kyiv when Monday's Russia strikes began. Michael Lippin spoke to her earlier and asked what it was like to experience the first Russian bombardment of Ukrainian capital in months.
Explosion was heard at around 8:20 in the morning. So I was at home and it was a very powerful explosion that happened. It was not far from my apartment building. So everything was shaking, basically. The apartment itself, the windows. And of course, me and my husband, we immediately went to the shelter, to the bomb shelter. We are quite lucky. We have an underground apartment building. So all our neighbors and we as well, we were there for all these 5 hours because the attack, bombardment basically was happening for 5.5 hours in a row. And I should say that it was not just one explosion. It was a series of explosions and it was a little delay and another series of explosions. And for all this time, different kind of explosions were heard. So sometimes we were hearing some really powerful sounds and sometimes sounds of air defense missiles working in the air and destroying the missiles that were targeting the city.
So were you able to get outside eventually? And what did you see?
The missiles hit the central part of the city, very, very central part of Kyiv. And some of the victims were in their cars on the way to work when the missile hit one of the sites. So people died inside of their cars. What I've seen that most of the attacks were targeting critical infrastructures. This is first of all. Second of all, the areas in the city center where a lot of civilians were concentrated in this point of time, because this early in the morning, people either were at home or were on their way to work.
That's reporter Anna Chernikova speaking with Flashpoint Ukraine's Michael Lipin from Kyiv. In an opening speech to the UNHCR's Executive Committee, UN High Commissioner for Refugees Filippo Grandi appealed to member states to provide protection to people fleeing conflict and persecution, regardless of ethnicity and nationality. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The UN Refugee Agency, or UNHCR, reports the number of people forcibly displaced by armed conflict, violence, discrimination, persecution, and climate shocks has hit an all-time high of 100 million. High Commissioner Filippo Grandi says the climate emergency increasingly drives displacement, making life harder for those already uprooted. He says the link between climate change and displacement is clear and growing.
We see it in the Horn of Africa, for example, where people are forced to flee by a combination of conflict and drought. More than 1 million have been displaced in Somalia alone since January 2021. Around 80% of refugees are from countries that are most affected by the climate emergency.
Most African refugees flee for safety to neighboring countries. However, many make the perilous journey to Europe in search of asylum and a better life. Grandi notes that they and refugees fleeing conflict and persecution from other parts of the world, such as Afghanistan and the Middle East, too often are turned back by European countries. He says the reception of these refugees stands in stark contrast to the generous welcome by European countries to some 7 million Ukrainian refugees who fled Russia's invasion of their country.
The Ukrainian crisis debunked so many myths that we have heard over the years from some politicians. Europe is full. Public opinion is against taking in more refugees. Relocation is impossible.
He says efforts to deny access to territory for those seeking asylum, often through violent pushbacks, must be rejected.
I also reject what we have heard some politicians on this continent tell their voters, that Ukrainians are real refugees, while others fleeing similar horrors but from different parts of the world are not. There is only one word to define this attitude, racist.
Grandi adds failures on the part of member states to uphold their international protection obligations is deeply worrying and concerning. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
North Korea says its recent barrage of missile launches were simulated use of its tactical battlefield nuclear weapons to, quote, hit and wipe out, unquote, potential South Korean and U.S. targets. Its leader, Kim Jong-un, has signaled he would conduct more provocative tests. Monday's North Korean statement, released on the 77th birthday of his ruling party, is seen as an attempt to buttress public unity behind Kim as he struggles to overcome difficulties such as pandemic-related economic hardships. For more, I spoke with VOA's chief national correspondent, Steve Herman, who had worked extensively in the region.
Actually, my sixth decade of monitoring the Korean Peninsula, and it is always dangerous there, and the present situation is no exception. The dangers go up and down. It's sort of like a roller coaster over the weeks, months, years, and decades on the Korean Peninsula.
That's VOA's chief national correspondent, Steve Herman, speaking with me from Washington, D.C. The COVID-19 pandemic forced some governments to think of innovative ways to help their citizens through hard times. In Togo, satellite data and artificial intelligence helped target aid to the neediest. VOA Steve Baragona explains.
Eli Kamako is a mason. He says business dried up in Togo's capital, Lome, when the COVID-19 pandemic hit in 2020.
Without orders, we cannot work and earn a little money to feed our families. It was a blow for us.
Millions of people like Kamako suddenly were pushed to the edge of extreme poverty by pandemic shutdowns around the world. Governments scrambled to provide aid. But there was one big problem, says University of California, Berkeley computer scientist Emily Aiken.
And the issue is that in a lot of countries, especially low and middle income countries, they didn't have a lot of data on who to give aid to.
In a country of 8 million people with vast rural areas, how do you locate the neediest people? That's where satellite images came in, says Aiken's boss, Josh Blumenstock.
If you or I go to Google Maps or some satellite data provider and look at an aerial image of one town or another, you can sort of tell whether it's wealthy or not. Wealthier homes tend to have metal roofs, poorer homes tend to have thatched roofs, wealthier neighborhoods have paved roads, bigger plots of land, more spaced out. There's a lot of information in that imagery.
Intelligence to recognize these patterns. The AI came up with a map of the poorest regions of Togo. The next step was to target the neediest people in these regions. So they put AI to work studying patterns of mobile phone use, Aiken says. Writing in the journal Nature, Aiken and colleagues say the system did a better job identifying needy people than the Togolese government's first attempt to target aid. Steve Barragona, VOA News.
In other news, the United Nations Security Council is evaluating options, including the immediate activation of foreign troops, to help free Haiti from grips of gangs that has caused a scarcity of fuel, water, and other basic supplies. A letter on Sunday submitted to the Council by UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres says such a force would, quote, remove the threat posed by armed gangs and provide immediate protection to critical infrastructure and services, unquote, as well as secure the, quote, free movement of water, fuel, food, and medical supplies from ports and airports to communities and healthcare centers, unquote. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. This week marks 20 years since the terrorist bombings on the Indonesian island of Bali. 202 people died in the attack on 12th October 2022. Phil Mercer reports from Sydney.
The atrocity in Bali 20 years ago is the largest loss of life suffered by Australians in a terrorist attack. At about 11 p.m. local time on 12 October 2002, three bombs were detonated in Bali, Indonesia. Two exploded at popular tourist destinations, the Sari Club and Paddy's Bar, the third in front of the American consulate. The victims came from more than 20 countries, including Indonesia, Britain, the United States, Brazil, Germany and New Zealand. Australia suffered the largest loss with 88 fatalities. The attack was carried out by the Al-Qaeda-linked Jamaat Islamiya militant organisation. More than 30 people were eventually arrested for their involvement. The suspected mastermind Hambali, also known as Ensep Najaman, is being held at the United States facility at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba and has been held since 2006. Three other key conspirators were executed in Indonesia in November 2008. Almost 200 Australians would later receive formal recognition for their bravery and the help they gave in the aftermath of the bombings. Rick Smith, who was the Australian ambassador to Indonesia in 2002, told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation Monday that the response to the bomb blasts was heroic.
People dived into the bomb site and recovered people, helped friends out, helped people they didn't know out to safety, carried them to the hospitals, carried them to the clinics, took them to the hotel foyers where they could be attended to. They were heroes on the spot, on the day.
Australia's Minister for Foreign Affairs, Penny Wong, said in an August 27 statement that the anniversary of the bombings would be a difficult day for many in Australia, Indonesia and around the world, and our thoughts are with the survivors, families and loved ones of those killed. Senator Wong also praised efforts by Indonesia and Australia to combat the scourge of violent extremism. The Australian government will hold a memorial service at Parliament House in Canberra to mark the anniversary on 12 October. A commemorative ceremony will also be held on the same day at the Australian Consulate General in Bali, Indonesia. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Thank you, Phil. And the UN Children's Agency, UNICEF, says child marriage and female genital mutilation, FGM, are on the rise in the Horn of Africa as a devastating drought intensifies, pushing families to the edge. From the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, Ruben Kayama reports for VOA.
Some say girls as young as 12 are being forced into child marriage and female genital mutilation at alarming rates. Emmanuel Kumper is the UNICEF Regional Gender Advisor for Eastern and Southern Africa.
Over the last 10 years, there has been an increased attention on issues that matter to girls by government in the regions, but the investment in adolescent girls remain far too limited, and they continue to face increased risk of child marriage, early pregnancy, and HIV infection. We have the highest adolescent pregnancy rate in the world, with alarming trends in Mozambique and Angola. And we know that every week, more than 3,000 girls are newly infected by HIV in Eastern and Southern Africa.
She spoke with VOA as the world prepares to mark the International Day of the Girl, celebrated annually on October 11th. According to the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, several countries in the Horn of Africa, including Somalia, Ethiopia, and Kenya, are suffering a historic drought that is affecting the lives of more than 36 million people. Hafsa Omar is a 19-year-old girl from Somaliland.
In my country now, they are going through FGM, although there are lots of awareness, but it's still like it's something which is going on because it's part of our culture, and it's a taboo that young girls cannot talk about it. Again, it's going back to the psychological health-related things, because when a young girl goes through this, she never has the chance to talk about it. She cannot express her feelings. She cannot say her opinions.
In an assessment carried out in Somaliland earlier this year, almost a quarter of the people interviewed reported a rise in gender-based violence due to drought, including child marriage and domestic and sexual violence. Omar says girls have faced new challenges this year as a result of the triple threat of COVID, conflict, and climate change.
You know, lots of young girls were having mental health issues. It was a really hard time during the COVID, having the droughts and all that. It wasn't easy to find someone to talk about how this thing impacts our lives, how it changed our lives, because out of nowhere, the world changed into from face-to-face conversations to just virtual meetings.
UNICEF says in Ethiopia, child marriage has on average more than doubled in the space of 1 year, especially in areas worst affected by the drought. In Tanzania, child marriages too seem to be on the rise, but UNICEF and Tanzanian authorities have launched a campaign aimed at ending the practice. Nabiha Kasim Ali is a youth activist with UNICEF Tanzania.
Kampeni hii yani inashughulika na kuondoa kabisa sheria ya ndoa ya mwaka 1971.
She says this campaign seeks to outlaw the 1971 Law of Marriage Act, which currently allows girls to marry at 14 with court consent and 15 with parental consent. Child marriage and FGM drive girls out of school and leave them more vulnerable to domestic violence and a lifetime of poverty. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
This is Science in a Minute.
A new study by researchers at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Massachusetts suggests when you eat can impact your weight issues and overall health as much as what you eat. Previous research has shown that eating later in the day is linked with an increased risk of obesity, body fat, and lower weight loss success. The researchers say, according to a hospital press release, that they wanted to focus on the effects of late eating on obesity, even if healthy food was consumed and the individual burned many calories throughout the day. Study authors suggest late eating can make the difference in how hungry we are, how we burn calories after we eat, and the way our bodies store fat. The study detailing the researchers' findings has been published in the journal Cell Metabolism. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo. And long neck
eyes go, man, never broke my heart. If you like Luke Combs, Miranda Lambert,
Chris Stapleton, then you'll enjoy Country Hits VOA. I don't just play the songs rocking the U.S. Billboard Hot Country Songs chart. I'll tell you who's making news, and we'll hear from the artists themselves. Join me, Nikki Strong,
every Friday at 10 and 2200 UTC
for Country Hits VOA on VOA 1.
Go beyond the daily headlines with VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. Each weekday, join us as we put the latest developments into a global context with stories, interviews, and analysis. Listen online at voanews.com/flashpoint or in your favorite podcast player.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours at voanews.com and check out voaafrica.com for more English language programming. You can find International Edition on our current affairs programs and counter Press Conference USA and issues in the news on voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Chino Dolfo in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In response to the tragic and brutal death of a young Iranian woman, Mahsa Amini, as well as the violent suppression of peaceful protests, Secretary of State Antony Blinken has announced sanctions against Iran's so-called morality police and senior security officials. 22-year-old Mahsa Amini was arrested in Tehran for purportedly wearing a hijab too loosely. She died while in custody of Iran's so-called morality police. Street patrols by the morality police in Iran intensified this summer. President Ibrahim Raisi had called for strict enforcement of laws imposed after the revolution in 1979 that obliged women to cover their hair and wear long, loose-fitting clothes. Protests throughout Iran erupted after Amini's death. They have been met with force by the authorities. The Iranian government's crackdown is ongoing. Authorities have reportedly killed dozens of protesters, and last week the Iranian government cut off access to the internet for most of the 80 million citizens to prevent them and the rest of the world from watching its ongoing violent crackdown on peaceful protesters. In a separate statement, the Treasury Department said the officials designated by the Office of Foreign Assets Control oversee organizations that routinely employ violence to suppress peaceful protests and members of Iran's civil society, political dissidents, women's rights activists, and members of the Baha'i community. The seven designated officials include Iran's Minister of Intelligence and Security, the head of Iran's Morality Police, and the head of its Tehran division. The sanctions also target the deputy commander of the Basij, the deputy commander of Iran's Law Enforcement Forces, the LEF, the LEF commander of Chahar Mahal and Bakhtiari province, and the commander of the Iranian Army's ground forces. These men have been involved in serious rights abuses, including violence against detainees and the use of deadly force against protesters. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen called the death of Mahsa Amini another act of brutality by the Iranian regime's security forces against its own people. She added, "We condemn this unconscionable act in the strongest terms and call on the Iranian government to end its violence against women and its ongoing violent crackdown on free expression and assembly." Today's actions, Secretary Yellen declared, demonstrates the Biden-Harris administration's clear commitment to stand up for human rights and the rights of women in Iran and globally.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.